Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Andrea Hollander Buddy. Andrea Hollander Buddy's new book of poems, Woman in the Painting, was published by Autumn House Press in 2006. She is the author of two other full-length collections, including House Without a Dreamer, which won the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize, and three award-winning chapbooks. Other honors include the D.H. Lawrence Fellowship, a Pushcart Prize for Memoir, the Runes Poetry Award, and two fellowships from the Arkansas Arts Council, and two fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts. Welcome.
Thank you, Jan.
We're happy to have you, and we're really happy to have you visit through Autumn House Press, which brings us some really great authors. So thanks to Michael Sims for that. So you're going to start with something from Woman in the Painting.
I thought I'd start with the title poem.
Okay.
In many ways, the title poem introduces issues that I deal with throughout the book. Woman in the Painting. Her face has disappeared. This happens more often than you think. She sits at a table with her hands in her lap beside her husband, his arms folded over one another, blue bowls and empty glasses set out before them, and a pitcher of translucent milk. If the woman had eyes, they would be the hazel eyes of my mother, her sadness exposed. If a mouth, my mother's, her upper lip with the scar she hid with lipstick. Like my mother, she would be better at listening than speaking. Afternoons after high school, my friends would come when their boyfriends had tired of them. They would sit at a table like this one, white and gleaming with food, and she would listen until it was time for my father to return, her dark hair pulled behind her ears, her silence laconic and wise. Perhaps the woman in the painting tried to speak, as my mother did, to her father, raising her face toward him like the mutt she once begged for, already cowering, but finally unable to utter a sound, language transformed to movement, to the trembling body suppliant before him, her pupils suddenly large and black, tears not yet formed, but forming. The husband's face is opulent. His eyes, the color of olives at the bottom of a drink. Perhaps the woman believes the man she married is only her husband. For a while, that's what we all think. And I would say that that poem introduces a section of the book that speaks to and of, and actually even from, in a sense, my mother's life. And I'll read another poem from that section. Sunday dinner. Always my grandparents arrived disguised as harmless elders. They'd say grace, bless the three of us and our small residence above my father's office. Residence. I don't choose the word for the poem's sake, but because it was their word. I want you to hear what I heard through all those years before my mother's death, all those Sunday briskets and pot roasts, all those potatoes she and I peeled on Saturdays, and the pies whose crusts we dispatched till it became ritual, the way I thought the making of the host must be ritual for those who toil in some secret bakery blessed by a bishop. I haven't forgotten. I wrote disguised. And I know you might wonder if I should have changed that word before I called this poem finished. I meant they had harmed someone. Not me, who believed in the prayers they uttered, but my mother, who inhabits me each time I roll out the dough as she did, shape it, fit it to the pan, fill it with mincemeat or apples, pinch the edges together with my thumb and forefinger, and with the tines of my fork, prick it, and prick it, and prick it. So it's interesting to me that when I was working on this book, I was really working on many poems having to do with my father. And I thought, because I've written two previous collections, first of which was quite focused on my mother's life and death, but more her death than anything because I was suffering from that myself. And I thought I'd finished writing poems about my mother. I guess we don't finish writing poems about people who matter to us and people who inhabit us no matter what. And so issues that came up in my mother's life that were important to her but were not necessarily uttered by her during the bulk of my childhood, at least she didn't talk to me about these things. But some of them came out subtly, and I found myself feeling as though I needed to work with that material even in this book. And so it ended up being a big chunk of the present collection. And I thought I'd read two more poems from that part of the book. And this particular poem reveals in many ways one of the problems my mother had with her father. The poem is called 1938. I remember the way my mother answered when people asked where she'd gone to school. Southside High, 1938. Adding the year in the same breath, though I knew she never graduated. Yanked out when her father lost his job. Now it was her turn to make herself useful, he told her. Hadn't he put food on the table all her life and all her little sisters? How necessary to tell a lie like hers, to answer Southside High, 1938, and smile without betraying the blaze in her chest, her envy for the questioner who likely met her own husband at some university. But wasn't my mother the lucky one? My grandfather was fond of telling her, even into my childhood, sometimes in front of my friends. Lucky to have got my father, a college man who sat beside her at a ball game in 1939. Just look at her, who didn't finish high school. Didn't I tell her then it wouldn't matter? But of course it did matter, and it mattered a lot. And I suppose when I grew up, I wasn't thinking about the fact that women were put in categories and had to have certain expectations and not other expectations put upon them. And of course, we're talking about the 1950s when the women's movement hadn't happened yet. But as I've grown through all of that myself, I start to think and feel those resentments my mother felt. Here's a very short poem from the same section. My grandmother taking off my grandfather's shoes. Every day after work, he'd sit in his armchair with its antimacassar and its plush burgundy velour, and she'd kneel on the floor to unfasten the laces, loosen the tongues, and lift out his feet. When I was 10, I stayed for a week and did it for her. He thought I did it for him.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Andrea Hollander Buddy, reading from her new book of poems, Woman in the Painting, published by Autumn House Press. You started talking about some of this, but I want to talk a little more about this sense of witness that's really throughout your book. And I love that line in your poem, I want you to hear what I heard. It's such a great line, and it has such emotional power. And there's this sense of the daughter speaking for the mother in these poems that evokes such power and sorrow at the same time. It's really stunning. So I just wanted to say that. But I guess one of my questions is how you decided sort of how to write these poems, because it seems like there are so many pitfalls around writing the family, the so-called family poem. And there's also a lot of, I think, backlash in the poetry community around this, you know, don't write the family poem, which, you know, in a sense, who cares about that? But it's hard to write these family poems without, you know, falling into, you know, sentimentality, which you never do. And there's a great balance of subtlety and evoking this great power. So can you talk about, you know, how you approach these poems in terms of craft?
For one thing, I have always admired art, which is on one hand artifice, on the other hand marrow. And it's the poems by other people that I go back to that do that. They turn my insides out. And so I've aspired to write poems that might do that myself. So in terms of the art, that's the goal. Of course, the craft is where you have to go in. And when I'm dealing with emotional information, I'm not always sure that I'm doing that. What I do is I put that in the background, and I look to issues of craft to trick myself out of protecting that part of myself. And so in these poems that I worked on, not just the mother poems, but there's a section about my father as well in the middle of the book, I had to look away from... I always think about it as looking over my own shoulder when I'm writing rather than looking directly. Someone else is looking over my shoulder. And that way I'm not so afraid to look in. And I don't worry about sentimentality when I'm drafting something. Once I realize where I am and that I'm in the middle of something that's got blood and guts and it's slimy and smelly, I don't look away. But I don't think about it as the body or my body or my mother's body or my father's body or whoever I'm speaking about or whatever emotional issue I'm dealing with. I try to simply allow myself to go in and in and in. If it's a crummy poem when I'm done, or if it does go over the edge of sentimentality and start drowning, it doesn't come out of my notebook. But if it can be held as a vessel, if I find the final gesture of the poem without having planned on it, if I discover it rather than planning on it, then I find there's something to work with. And so then I work on the polish. And if there's and I try to stay away from it for a while once I've drafted it, so when I come back to it, if I can read it the way a stranger might, because I don't recognize myself in it, and I'm sure as a writer yourself and maybe listeners who are poets, writers themselves would also understand what I'm speaking about. You come back to the mess that you've tried to create something from, and if you don't recognize it as your own and it still works for you, then you know that there's something there that you can craft and polish and keep.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about that you're interested in the balance between artifice and marrow, I guess can you talk about what you mean by artifice? Do you mean what you were just talking about, that, 'cause when I think of artifice, I think of, you know, sort of false barrier or...
Yeah, I don't mean that.
Okay.
I do mean art.
Okay.
I mean craft and art. And what I mean by artifice isn't artificial, which
okay.
is where that word also seems to drive itself.
Yeah.
But what I do mean is that we know that a poem isn't real life in the sense that it's made out of language. And language even is urging itself towards the real and isn't the real.
Okay.
And so what I'm saying is that a poem we know is something whose script is written on the page, but it doesn't come alive until it's in your body, in your mouth, in your ear. But it's also a made thing. It's not life. It's not just a blurting out of real life. It is the combination of that marrow, that deep in the bone world that we endure and celebrate and hide from. And it's the craft and art of literature, good poems that work together to bring that marrow alive. Okay. So that we know that it's there. Okay. It's there anyway,
yeah.
But we don't know it's there until art touches us.
Okay.
So that's what I mean.
Okay.
And that's what my desire is. And I fail so often, but that's what my desire is when I write.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. Let me read Tiny Spider in the Bathroom Sink. I tried to be careful. It lounged along the left side of the bowl, the smallest I've ever seen, a dot with legs, an asterisk. I turned the water only slightly on and aimed the thin stream directly toward the drain and watched the spider squat on all eight minuscule legs and raise itself again. But after I brushed my teeth the full 2 minutes to appease my dentist, and held the foamy brush under the water and flicked the bristles with my thumb to help release the minty suds, I forgot it was there and opened the faucet full force and rinsed my mouth and spat and saw too late the dark speck spiraling down. And I began to understand how it happened that after the doctor announced the bleak diagnosis and looked down at his silent desk, my father said, as if it were someone else whose life and death they were discussing, "Oh, isn't that sad?" So, just say for a few moments what that poem did to me is that it imitates exactly what happened in my life. My father was going through a terrible time with Alzheimer's, although I guess it's a blessing, or maybe not, that one of the aspects of that disease is that sometimes people who are struck by it do not realize in the depths what's going on with them, as in that poem. But those who love the sufferers also suffer, and so in the midst of anything, we can find out, without wanting to, or maybe wanting to, what the depths of those feelings might be for the other. And so we can't escape it either. I'll read a couple of other poems on that subject, if we have time. In the sixth year of my father's illness, I wonder if he remembers the jay that flew into the living room window that first day he introduced himself to the neighbor he'd known 40 years. It lay among the crushed pine bark we spread the previous May, around the roses where the roots were smooth and thornless, that jay so blue, and too beautiful to move, he said. And it stayed beautiful, even as the ants paraded in and out of its head, removing little bits to their underground country. Afterwards, its body lay still, and still beautiful, as if death had not yet occurred to it, its feathers blue as the sky it once knew so well, that sky it mistook for the real thing. Some truths we cannot learn, some we forget, as my father did, who yesterday introduced himself to me. And one of the things that struck me during my father's long illness, and I don't think that I was almost going to say battle, but there isn't a battle. Alzheimer's wins. There's no way you can fight it. Those around you fight it for you, but you don't fight it. You just deal with it. One of the things I discovered was that Ralph Waldo Emerson had the same disease, although didn't have the name for it at the time. And this next brief poem I'm going to share, everything I say about Emerson is absolutely true for him. Emerson fought his by labeling everything in his house, its name, its use, clock, the thing that counts time, umbrella, the thing that strangers take away. Sundays I phone my father's house to hear his voice. It's Andrea, I say, your daughter. Telephone, the thing that says it is your daughter.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Andrea Hollander Buddy, reading from her new book of poems, Woman in the Painting, which is published by Autumn House Press. And again, we want to say that we're really happy to have you on Prosody, and we're grateful to Autumn House Press for the writers that they bring into town. I want to go back to something you said about obsessions and when we think we're done with things as writers. And I was sort of surprised that you said it, because I guess I think of obsessions like one or two or three obsessions that we all have as writers that we carry through a lifetime. I think it was Willa Cather who said we have two or three things that we write about forever, and hopefully as time goes on, we write about them better. And so I guess I was sort of surprised when you said, I thought I was done with that. Did you really think you were done with writing about the mother poems?
Well, I hoped that I had squeezed the sponge dry, because I thought I'd gone deep enough, but I hadn't. Mm-hmm. And I think Willa Cather is right. I hadn't heard that, and I'm glad to know it, because she is absolutely right. I think I try to write away from my obsessions to see what else there is in there, and they keep sneaking back in. Mm-hmm. So, to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, don't you think that there will always be the mother poems in your work? I mean, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I'm sure there... Yes, just the way memory works as well. I'm fascinated by the brain anyhow. If I weren't a literary person, if I were a scientist, I'd be studying the brain, because I'm just amazed at what memory and what kind of power it has. Why do we keep some images and some memories and not others? And they're not always the ones you think you're going to keep. And so they pop in. So why not? Why not in poetry, of course. But I'm so interested in why those obsessions. Some of them are so obvious, but some of them are not. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated with that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I won't get away from it. But I try to write about other things, and they come sneaking in.
Well, this issue of what is kept and what is not is, I think, shows up in your writing in other ways. Because one thing that kept coming to me when I was reading your work is this issue of balance and restraint, because it seems to me so much is left out of your work in a good way, that, you know, the choice of detail seems to be so precise that we're given a few details that do the work of many, which is, I think, a sign of really strong writing. But I kept feeling that sense of spareness that and subtlety all through your work. And I wonder, in your writing process, if there was a lot more that was cut out.
No, is the answer. So whole poems are cut out. Mm-hmm. But in the poems that survive, it seems to me that the spareness is what keeps me going. The spareness of image, the fact that it's just the tip of the leaf, not even the whole leaf, certainly not the tree, all of that. And I always found that those kinds of poems by others are what keep me going, too. That fact that you have to let the reader in. If you do all the work, as you know well, yeah. Then the reader has no place to be. You can't fit the reader in at all.
Yeah, it's a one-person show.
Yeah, and I admire poets who invite me in. And so I'm in their marrow as well.
Right. Well said. Okay. We have time for a couple more poems.
Okay. I'm going to change the subject. This is a poem called A Poem About Lust That's Not About Sex. I have one scar. I scraped my foot against a reef. You know how it is when something so startles you into your life. You forget you're anything but eyes or ears or mouth. It doesn't have to hurt. I'm talking about certain swells of music your bones recognize, as if they created them, and now they've come home. Or the first drop of honey on the tongue, the kiss that overtakes the body, produces secrets you didn't know it held. 5 feet down, the world changes. Close to the reef where the sun stretches in, you can sometimes see into the constricted caves and crevices. In and out of them rush tiny, translucent fish, colorful as jewels. Deeper, blue turns black, the underside rough and unpredictable, like a man's unexpected hand on a first date. Some fish accumulate in the reef's pockets, then flash all at once as if there's an odor pulling them. Must be like the sweetness of dawn when I lived above a bakery. All that yeast rising through the floorboards. My sleeping mouth watered, waking me. This isn't supposed to be a poem about sex, but if I were a woman allowed to speak her hungers, it would be. Okay, and I'm going to end with a short poem called X, as in EX. Long after I married you, I found myself in his city and heard him call my name. Each of us amazed, we headed to the cafe we used to haunt in our days together. We sat by a window across the paneled room from the table that had witnessed hours of our clipped voices and sharp silences. Instead of coffee, my old habit in those days, I ordered hot chocolate, your drink, dark and dense the way you take it, without the swirl of frothy cream I like. He told me of his troubled marriage, his two difficult daughters, their spiteful mother, how she tricked him and turned into someone he didn't really know. I listened and listened, glad all over again to be rid of him, and sipped the thick brown sweetness slowly as I could, licking my lips, making it last.
The poetry of Andrea Hollander Buddy, reading from her book, Woman in the Painting. Thank you so much. It was great.
Thanks, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.